The meeting of the LCC Preparedness for Terrorism and Disasters Working Group will come to order. I believe we have a quorum, and we have, well, first, I would mention that in this room, the microphones, you can't always tell if they're picking you up or not, and so I was advised that members of the commission should try to speak up, and the microphones will pick us up even if we can't hear. There are meetings, meeting minutes in the packet. I'm sure that we've had a chance to review them carefully, and if there are any suggested changes, we can direct those towards staff, but I would entertain a motion to approve those minutes.
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Minutes are approved. First up, we have 2008 Republican National Convention training and preparation in St. Paul. We have Assistant Chief Matt Bostrom to give us an overview. Please proceed and identify yourself for the record.
Sure. Assistant Chief Matt Bostrom, St. Paul Police Department. And just here to discuss and really answer any questions that you might have as far as the 2008 Republican National Convention preparations as they're unfolding in St. Paul. As a means of introduction, we are on schedule. We are ahead of the traditional planning and previous national special security events, of which this is one. And is the Committee on Arrangements, which is the planning arm for the Republican National Convention, continues to do their preparations. We are in constant touch with them. At the same time, looking at meeting the needs of the greater St. Paul and looking at this as a regional response as opposed to just simply something specific to the Xcel Energy Center. So we're working closely with all of our public safety partners. I'll name a few, but you can imagine that this really goes throughout the five-county metro area and probably will extend beyond that. Oftentimes, there's quite a, what I've encountered is a great deal of, I'm not sure what the technical term is, but maybe urban legends associated with convention planning. And to the extent that it would be of assistance to you, I'd be delighted to answer any of those questions or delve into some of the concerns that you may have. At this point, Secret Service has been partnering closely with us since April. And they have been profoundly helpful and professional in their manner. They have been truly effective in managing federal resources and have been working closely with us as we manage all the resources that are not federal resources. So therefore, that means that we interact with state, county, and municipal agencies in order to get our planning goals successfully implemented. We still are in a place where there hasn't been a great deal on paper. What I mean by that is an operational plan will probably be one of the last things that gets done because there's so many unknowns, there's so many stakeholders in an event of this magnitude that that part is probably last. What's important is to make sure that we have the right people at the table so that as, and when I say the right people, subject matter experts in a variety of areas, to name a few, it would be fire, life safety, hazmat, as well as transportation, venue security, and things like that. And what I point out to my law enforcement colleagues is that what we're being asked to do is much of what we do whenever there's a presidential nominee or presidential visit to the state of Minnesota. Many of the same things that we do at those times, we will be doing exactly the same work during the Republican National Convention, just for an extended period of time. And some people say that's an oversimplification, slightly, but not a great deal. It really is what we will be asked to do. And we'll be doing motorcades, we'll be protecting venues, we will be assisting with credentialing, we'll be helping with those. That will be our core functions during this event. And it really is a security event. Some people have drifted into perhaps some thinking that they tend to think it's a catastrophe, and I'd invite people to consider it differently. A bridge collapse is indeed a catastrophe. This is a security event, and there have been 21 successful national special security events before this. Secret Service has been, they've improved upon it every time that they put one together. In the same fashion, we've had the opportunity to visit with our law enforcement colleagues from the cities, respective cities that have hosted events similar in scope and scale, and have had a great deal of opportunity to literally walk the deck, review their plans, take what were best practices for them, and develop them so that they fit for the state of Minnesota and the city of St. Paul. And so as a means of an overview without, as you can imagine, as I start unpacking all of this, I can go for a while. So with that in mind, if there are some specific things that I might be able to answer for you, I'd be delighted to do so.
Are there questions from the committee? Senator Limmer.
Thank you. Sir, I've been noticing people send me correspondence via internet of political organizations that are making no secret to making St. Paul quite an event of their own in the shadow of the national convention. They're usually politically motivated. Some have equated what will happen in St. Paul to be akin to the 1968 Chicago convention, and have law enforcement or the national authorities been following some of this as it's developing? And I'm seeing some things from all corners of the country with that in mind. And could you assure me or assure the committee here that you're aware of some of this?
Please? Sure, Senator, I appreciate the question. And we have indeed looked at that, and as we've, in order to move forward, I have a tendency to step back a little bit, take a look at where things have been, what were some of the precursors to those events. Certainly in 1968, I think there were a lot of precursors, both before, during, and after that event, that would indicate that public unrest was not only likely, it would be hard to believe that it wouldn't have occurred. And so that's one thing that we look for as we prepare for events. What's the political climate? Some have said, well, what if there's 100,000 people demonstrating? And I said, that doesn't concern me a whole. I asked the question, well, do they have a permit or not? I said, well, let's say they have a permit. I said, well, in all likelihood, we're not going to have a problem. That really, as you can imagine, people that go through that process to get a permit, to exercise their free speech rights, and that's why they got the permit, is to do that and to exercise those according to the Constitution and with respect to other Americans. In this regard, I believe that that's exactly what's going to be occurring in St. Paul. Are there some people that find great entertainment in disrupting an event? Yeah, they're out there, and that really is our underlying task, is to deal with those that might want to otherwise undermine free speech rights, undermine the police department, undermine the event. And so we feel like we're in a good position to interact and not have to deal with large amounts of unrest. Now, something for us to watch is, does the political climate change as we move into the spring and summer? What do the campuses look like? What are our major cities look like? What do the demonstrations, what are the particular issues of that time? And is there any trends that we might start to see? And I think at that point we'll be able to build some models that would say, yeah, you know what, we may want to take a little bit different approach to this, that this isn't simply just an exercise of free speech. Rather, there are people that are coming here to do some damage. And at that point, you know, then we'll continue to calibrate our response plan accordingly.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I can agree with Senator Limmer, and those are my concerns too. I'm concerned particularly about the young people who do go to college in our community. We have such a large campus, and I'm concerned that with the political climate that we will see large amounts of student unrest and have a concern for their safety, and would certainly not want to repeat what history has shown us to be very damaging to our young people. And so I'm skeptical about that group doing the proper permit process. And so I'm wondering, you know, how do you treat, and do you have a plan for if it is chaos, and if those are our young people participating in that chaos?
What I'm using to make my projections at this point is just based on what I know and what I've been able to observe. Let's just go back to 2004. There was quite a bit of negative energy associated with the campaigns during that time. If you were to monitor the campuses, there were some protests, not a great deal of volatility. You know, and so those will be things that we'll continue to watch if we track accordingly. And New York and Boston both have sizable student populations to draw from. So I don't think that that's an unreasonable model to kind of look at and use as a baseline to kind of anticipate a similar response here. The campuses in St. Paul and in the metro area, we enjoy a strong partnership with, and we want to see them succeed. And we don't, at this point, the presidents of those schools, the student bodies, and so on. I think the concern for us is somewhat, as you asked, Senator, is what about some of these outliers that are coming in to disrupt? What about that? What are we going to do to protect them? And I believe that we have a strong enough relationship, and they trust us enough that we're going to be able to intercede on their behalf. So if there are people that want to otherwise disrupt a peaceful protest, it's our job as law enforcement to be able to strategically take care of that without doing some sort of mass arrest scenario or something like that, whereas where there's been difficulties in the past. So we've had some very positive, as I've said, there's some very positive lessons out there. Those are the quiet lessons that are learned during these. The ones that are the difficult ones are the ones that we kind of that we keep replaying those tapes and hope that that doesn't happen in St. Paul. But there's a lot of great best practices out there, and I feel strongly that we're positioning ourselves that this is going to be a. I could say I'm just being an optimist. I'm not. I'm a reasoned optimist. I have great reason right now today to believe that this will indeed be the best event of this nature held in our country. I have no reason to believe otherwise.
Dr. Osterholm?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief, first of all, congratulations on everything I've seen so far and have heard from others. Your planning has been really stellar, and the coordination around it has been quite exceptional. So I'm optimistic that a lot of what you're talking about is moving forward. I guess the question I have for you is, in this way, I guess for this group to be embodied here today and what we're hearing and what hopefully we will come forward with is recommendations for the potential to improve on these situations we're dealing with. Yours is yet to come, but if you had a magic wand right now, what one or two issues, assets, resources, authorities that you would like to have that you don't have that would make it easier for you, more comprehensive planning, et cetera, what would it be that we might acknowledge would be helpful for you to get?
Thank you for the question. As I think about that, you know, as I come forward, I always have a laundry list of things that, but let me just narrow it down to probably two that would be the ones that I would put to the front of my list. One is to, is almost a philosophical, but really probably a state role, is to consider refining the state mutual aid response language. You know, how do we respond mutually to each other when we found, we only look at those after an event, you know, so for instance with the Minneapolis bridge collapse or the 35W bridge collapse, that's the time where we went and responded and we assisted in that matter. But when you look back, you think, well, was that language sufficient for what we needed to get the job done? Now, we can make those individually, but if there was a way within the state that we could manage those resources, because the types of issues that we're dealing with, particularly the international event, those transcend boundaries. They not just city boundaries, county boundaries, but they're going to be all over the state. So a realization that maybe there's a way to take the mutual aid language and refine that in such a way that it would meet the needs of a catastrophic event as well as an international public safety response. That's one. And the other thing where there's quite a bit of momentum, but perhaps some additional funding, could be useful in the area of interoperable communication. As the metro area continues to move refining its ability to use the 800 megahertz bandwidth, for interagency communication, those would be the two primary areas that I'd suggest consideration.
Good, thank you.
Mayor Anderson, I think, has a question.
Yes, and thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow up on Dr. Osterholm's question. That was mine too, and I wondered in the planning, how many other agencies or other levels of government, or specifically, what cities or counties have been involved in the preparation?
The main cities that have been involved thus far, let's start with the state, and that would be the State Patrol as a primary agency to assist us in this venture. The Department of Public Safety has been with us from the very beginning to assess what resources they may have to help us make this a success. But then the two main counties, in addition to the city of Minneapolis, Hennepin County, Ramsey County, and the city of Bloomington. Although there's many other agencies that have been assisting us with that, I don't want to leave anybody out. The National Guard, the Minnesota National Guard, has been very willing to make themselves available as the mission becomes clear in some support fashion at this point to assist in this venture. So those are really the key agencies that have been at the table coming up with some of the core planning, some of the philosophy that we want to use. And again, back to not just making it St. Paul specific, but looking at this as a regional response. So that's police, fire, emergency management, and what I would say are traditional public safety agencies.
And the city of Bloomington being involved, is that for Mall of America?
Yes, and they're also the third largest city as far in the metro area. And we know that they also have some assets that they provide that a lot of the other municipalities aren't able to provide. But yeah, Mall of America and their proximity also to the airport.
Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I assume the fact that we'll fill up every one of their hotel rooms while we're there. Chief Bostrom, I was at the Democratic Convention in Boston in 2004, and there they decided to handle the protesters by putting them in a five-sided cage. You know, it was just this little penned-in area. Please tell me you're not going to do that.
I'm going to say I'm not going to do that.
Okay.
I get asked questions similar to that, and they made decisions out there, and I want to say first that the Boston Police Department, how they responded to that, and I thought it was in many ways a model. I think there were six or seven arrests in total during the entire event. Some areas that they did have to go to court and explain why they were doing what they were doing associated with some of the protest zones, which is what I think you're describing, Senator. Maybe there were some geography reasons. They made some really good decisions out there. That one, I don't want to second guess them. It's one of those things in law enforcement. They were there, I wasn't. It's difficult for me to say that was a poor choice. But the way our geography lays out for downtown, the way that we understand, the courts have been clear. Sight and sound are something that we will afford. And so we'll be able to do that. I don't, the idea that there's only one place in the city of St. Paul where you could look at the front of the building and voice your opinion doesn't seem reasonable to me that I have to cordon that off and say, this is the only place you can do that. So although I get asked, there's some people that demand to know where that footprint is going to be, and it's like they want a place to stand, and they almost, when I say I haven't chosen one, and unless you make me choose one, I don't intend to. So at this point, there's going to be a lot of areas where you're going to be able to walk in and around the XL Energy Center. Now, obviously, as you get closer to the actual venue, you'll need tickets and credentials to get in. But outside of that, there may not be vehicles, but there'll certainly be foot traffic. Okay. So there's a lot of lines of sight area, things that we have to our advantage that Boston did not.
And thank you for that. Chief Bostrom, I see Chief Hestness right behind
mm-hmm.
you. Yep. Are you working with the university police as well in the planning? I hadn't thought about the whole concept that you had said about watching what's going on in the campuses to see mm-hmm. maybe what's going to happen here.
Chief Hestness has been a partner in emergency management and homeland security responses. They've had a great partnership with their agency. Earlier this afternoon, in fact, one of his lieutenants was at working with Ramsey County Chiefs Association. I was there for a briefing, and so they're fully on board and engaged, and we see them. You know, as we've had a chance to coordinate with them in joint responses, we anticipate doing exactly the same as we prepare for this event as well.
And then one more question, Mr. Chair, if I could. If there were some sort of health emergency or health catastrophe, are you trying to do some planning there as well, or would our other agencies, or somebody else working on that piece of it?
We have a specific subcommittee that their task, mission, goals, objectives is associated with fire life safety issues that could emerge as a result of the Republican National Convention. If the conditions were to get something that were larger than that, then the philosophy is we move over then, and that's when we work with our city's emergency operation plan, if there's a catastrophic event, a mass casualty type of incident. And so what we want to have is to exercise and practice and make sure that there's a seamless, you know, let's say we have a group of people that need some sort of rescue efforts, but it doesn't qualify as some sort of catastrophic event or a mass casualty event, but it's more than we would normally see. That's the level of planning that we will do. And then we'll use our tried and true and exercised emergency management plans if we need to move into a way that might be a mass casualty event. One of the things that I've been very fortunate in these events is they've played out over the last, 20 years, that they haven't resulted in that level of response. They've always stayed in the operational phase, which is what a security stage, if you want to call that. It's never become a rescue or response stage. So we think with prudent planning, we're going to be able to continue that. But as you know, we have plenty of time to plan contingencies, and that's exactly what we're doing. And there's, we have a couple subcommittees that's their task, to help us craft an appropriate level of contingency models that we could use in order to make the event even that more successful.
Thank you. Dr. Osterholm.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that, I think, Chief, that's a critical point you're raising right now. I think there are actually several things for consideration. Obviously, as we think about security, we talk about securing people, but also we're talking about securing goods. Food system security is going to be huge in terms of what we do in advance of to make sure that someone doesn't intentionally do that. But I would add that without question, if we even have a Mother Nature made event, initially, with as much media here, there'll be attention in every emergency room where people who might be experiencing some illness are going to. Mm-hmm. And one of the issues that's going to be very critical is obviously discerning intentional, unintentional. If it's unintentional, how do you explain it, that type of thing. And so those things have happened. The other area that I know that you're working on, which is critical, and there have been problems with this in the past, is that today, and I happen to be very involved in a national level with the BioWatch program, which is the air sampling program that's looking for the release of agents on an intentional basis. And depending on what kind of testing you're doing, some of these tests today can give us false positive tests. And you don't pick up the real positive until later down the line, and you're now stuck with this initial result. Ask the Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City about that, and you know what hell it can be to have an unknown for some hours before you are able to confirm differently. And so I think one of the issues we're all very interested and concerned about is how we're setting up that kind of testing so that we are obviously protecting the citizens as well as the participants with the kind of testing we can do, but at the same time making certain that we don't have a false positive that would cause incredible concern and immediate international attention on this issue. So I know that that's in the works, but I would emphasize how critical we got to look at that issue.
Thank you, and we will, and we'll continue to do that. And I think as part of that is the communication model that's associated with that, because oftentimes that spins things up into ways that the public gets into concerns that they may or may not need to have. And so we want to have a robust both internal communication plan as well as an external public communication plan. So
and if I could just add one piece, that's where I think it becomes important, because I think law enforcement will play obviously a critical role here. And it's not law enforcement's job to understand the nuances of certain kinds of test methods. And so today, where we find these to be a problem, and we've seen many false positives, whether in post offices, wherever, is making sure that the right health people are at the table to tell you to stand down, or this is one that we need to stand up, and to be certain what we're doing at that point, and allowing the public health people with the expertise in this area to be in a very central command position, because that's where we've seen ones in the past where uninformed, or at least, should we say, not people who haven't had sufficient experience or training, were making decisions based on a little bit of information, and that became a real problem. And of course, in a time like this, that just heightens itself. I mean, you might as well be walking on 10 blisters on your feet at that point. It's sensitive.
Yeah, thank you.
Further questions? Chief Bostrom, I have a couple of quick follow-ups, and I guess I can just ask them at the same time. You mentioned the need, potential need to modify the mutual response language and statute as one area that the state could help with. as well as additional funding for interoperable communications in the metro area. And I wonder if you could just comment on whether there is an existing mechanism or some agency or city that will be look at those issues and bring forth ideas for legislation in this session, or whether we should try to follow up with you and find out what may be needed. I guess you can answer that question first.
Well, thank you, Chair. Chairman, I think that maybe the way I'd like to address that is I'm going to defer to my emergency management colleagues. They are the experts. Rocco Forte, as well as Chief Butler and others, have been instrumental in allocation of urban area security initiative dollars, many of which have gone toward interagency communication throughout Hennepin County, Ramsey County, Dakota County. But as I'm aware that, you know, that's been a good start to bring it to completion, we could use some additional assistance. So that's the basis of which, and I defer to them as the experts because they've been able to track and been able to meet with the communication people as well, communication people from the counties, cities, as well as the public safety leaders in each of those venues. So now they're looking at me like, great, thanks for throwing me more work. But the point is, I have to acknowledge they are the experts. And I think we should probably do our homework on your behalf, and that would be that I'd work with our colleagues from the city to present you with some possible language to assist you as what we think might be what would work for the city, state, as well as for what FEMA is looking for when it comes to a mutual aid response, and how do we do those kinds of things. So I think that's a part that we take on some of that and do some homework, and if you're willing, we'd certainly be able to like to submit that back for consideration.
Thank you. The sooner we can do that, the better. We only have so much time that we're,
sure,
we can take those matters up.
Mm-hmm.
And the second follow-up question I have is that Mr. Forte at our last meeting talked about one of the lessons learned from the bridge collapse was the need for a more adequate emergency operations center. And I know that, again, this is a security event that we're talking about here, not a
sure
disaster event,
right,
or a terrorism event. But I'm wondering if you can comment about the need for St. Paul to have an emergency operations center similar to what Minneapolis is proposing.
It would be my recommendation that we do improve our emergency operations center. It is satisfactory. But there are some areas that we have been as resourceful as we can, and you've been able to track, I'm certain, how the city budgets have worked over the last several years. And so that, oftentimes the way it would go is at year end, if we were able to find some additional dollars, we'd like to, we'd reinvest those and put those in the emergency operations center. So, I mean, we have something that functions. I don't want people to leave with thinking that somehow we don't have something that works. State of the art, we're not there. We have a ways to go in order to do that. And without a doubt, it would be a great thing for our city as a capital city to have some support to help build out our emergency operations center so that we do meet with some of the standards and best practices that would be consistent with a city our size, particularly a capital city. Yes, but now that we're moving into starting to host international events as a region, it just seems to be prudent that we make an investment. And like I say, we're not talking numbers with lots and lots of zeros after them, but it is more than we typically would have in our emergency management budget in the city of St. Paul.
Thank you. Any further questions? Senator Limmer.
Thank you. Question I had on emergency preparedness center, is it important to have it as a permanent in the ground structure, or do you want something mobile? I think if there was an emergency of an intended event caused by other people, I would think a permanent structured emergency preparedness center could very well be a target, and maybe something that might be mobile might be more effective. I don't know how much equipment goes into a setting like that, but how do you compensate for a in-ground facility versus something that's mobile?
Great question, Senator. One of the things, it ends up becoming kind of size that you actually do need a larger footprint, that it would have to be probably a bricks and mortar structure of some sort to support the number of agencies that would be at the table. You can picture the mayor's office, health, police, fire, public works, and then finance and other groups that are going to fill that room, and then the energy level, if you're going to try to have a mobile group to fit all those people in there, would probably be challenging. However, the mobile command post, as we'd call it, is it would be a great asset for us. That often, and I think what you saw played out in Minneapolis, where you're able to actually do a mobile emergency operations center, where you start pulling a couple of them together. So you actually are able to get more people mobily into a room, and it also or into an area, which will then work as a as another emergency operations center. And so that is what we would like to do. The issue in St. Paul is that for as far as command posts go, we at the St. Paul Police Department is the one with a current command post, and it's okay. I mean, years ago it was world class, but you know, with time and technology, you know how that goes. Emergency management, St. Paul Fire are still waiting to put something together, and we'd love to have a joint public safety mobile command post, because it does serve as a fallback. That is, it is a danger having all your eggs in one basket, and to have that all at that bricks and mortar site without even a small mobile piece that you could trust and put someplace off site that would serve the purposes for response.
Mr. Chair, the reason I brought it up is as part of a bioterrorist emergency preparedness act that we created into law a number of years ago. We had this very same discussion. If there was a bioterrorist attack in a high urban setting environment, the bill had originally prepared itself for having a city hall or a designated building as being the headquarters for emergency response. But if you have an agent that's circulating by wind or it's a dirty bomb or a biological, you may be entrapping the very people that are key to the success of the safety of its citizens to be the ones that are the ground zero target. And you quickly eliminate the entire resource as well as the people that know what to do. And I'm a little concerned that, I know it's a difficult thing to plan for, but on the other hand, you've got to have some contingencies to prepare for as well.
Dr. Osterholm?
Well, if I can maybe just follow up on that and just one question. I think that you raise a very good point, and I know personally for me it was an issue prior to 9/11. There was a great deal of debate, some of us weighed in on, about the New York City Emergency Operations Center, which was located in World Trade Center Towers, which, of course, we all know what happened when that happened. There was redundancy for all the major phone systems in New York City. The problem is they were on different floors of the World Trade Center Tower. And so when that happened, it went. But what was probably more concerning was what New York did right after that. I don't know if how many of you are aware of this, but the immediate location of the EOC after the building collapse was under a warehouse right underneath the Brooklyn Bridge. It was right on top of it, literally. And I remember being in there right after 9/11 thinking, now, is this the smartest place to put this thing? This would seem like it would be very vulnerable at that point. And it was publicly known. But what New York has done, I think, has given us all hope that, in fact, just the point you made, is they've actually have a location now that's in the city of New York, but in a more of a community location, and it's quite well buffered by location so that access is limited. But more importantly, they have air systems and so forth so that if a biologic attack, a dirty bomb should ever be released, everyone inside is actually protected, and that it wouldn't be a problem. And I think we're a long ways from that kind of facility because they're not cheap. But I think in the end, for the state, they'd be well served by having an EOC where they could, in fact, wait out any kind of event that might happen, own their own power supplies, their own air supplies. They're far enough off that they could and they can keep people in them for days with the supplies they have in hand. Now, maybe we might not see ourselves at that high of a risk to have to do something like that, but I think more and more EOCs are moving to that kind of environment so they can have the kind of footprint that you talked about, Chief. So the question, can I just ask a question on that? And one last thing that comes up here and it may be difficult for you to comment in this meeting, I surely understand, but I think over the past 2 years, some of the frustrations that have been most shared between city, county, state, and federal, and then inside of federal, has been the issue of the ability to share intelligence information. And I, like colleagues, are worried about our Minnesota compatriots who might be a problem next summer, but I think I worry more about those from outside of Minnesota who may come in here with intent to disrupt this. And I guess, can you share with us your sense right now of the cooperative level of intelligence sharing between federal agencies, knowing that the FBI, the Secret Service, all have different responsibilities and different sets of information? And are you getting sufficient intelligence information that you need to do the planning that you need to do?
Thank you, Doctor. I think that the answer, the quick answer is yes. Since 9/11, particularly the 9/11 Commission report, that information sharing has continued to improve. And the FBI has been a good partner over the years. They continue to improve in their ability to share information, and the openness continues to grow. So as long as that continues in that fashion, I'm very, very satisfied. Secret Service and the FBI have a very good mechanism for sharing information. And as far as person-to-person across lines with Secret Service, who I work most closely with, it's fantastic. I can't speak more highly of a partnership with a federal agency than what the St. Paul Police Department enjoys with the Secret Service right now. There's, you know, I go into that, there's a lot of mystery there. What's it going to be like? I mean, we've interacted with them for shorter durations when there's been a nominee visit or something for reps, a Kerry visit or a Bush visit or something like that. Those are limited but intense meetings. This period of time has helped me develop a great appreciation, and largely it is because of their willingness to share information. And so again, it's good, and I'm glad to say it's improving.
Yeah. Senator Bono.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief Bostrom, have you considered, or would St. Paul, Minneapolis consider doing a shared emergency center, so that if we really were going to invest in the very best state-of-the-art kind of facility, that it might make more sense to do it together?
I hadn't given it great consideration, but if my colleagues from emergency management in St. Paul and Minneapolis, I trust them completely, if they make that recommendation, I would absolutely support them in that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Forte.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Quite frankly, we have looked at mobile command centers, which we have in Minneapolis and St. Paul mobile command bands, we call them. They're more for on-site of running the incident itself. The EOC takes such a large number of people that you really have to have a fixed facility. And you are correct, it does have to be hardened, the facility itself, with the security plan. We certainly looked into that. This would be a city, county, state asset, which Minneapolis built. Quite frankly, whatever emergency should arise, we would play any role that we could play in that, just as the state EOC is at this point in time. If there was nowhere else for us to go, we would actually use that asset. So from my perspective, this is my own perspective, cities of the first class that have large urban areas probably should have their own EOCs, and they should not be in the heart of other downtown areas. But definitely we should be able to share those facilities back and forth. The key is to have the right technology in that facility and have trained people throughout the community. Minneapolis EOC will never be used just by Minneapolis resources. There will always be county, state, city, county, and state people that would come in and help us with it, whatever emergency we have. We also have state emergency management teams right now, where if we were to lose one of our teams, we bring in other individuals that are trained to come in and work in those EOCs. We have the people, we do not have the EOCs.
I guess the follow-up question then is, as we're looking for priorities in this legislative session of investing in an EOC or multiple EOCs, you mentioned each city should have its own. Prior to the Republican convention, does it make sense for us to have the state-of-the-art facility in Minneapolis that can be used in the short term while we build these out over the long term, or is there a need to get two up and running soon? Those are questions we're going to have to grapple with pretty quickly.
From my perspective, Minneapolis is ready to move. We've got the site facility. We do have dollars that we are putting into it. We have urban area technology dollars that we're putting in. So we're ready to move, and I think rather than have a discussion how many we should have and what's the right time, let's get one up that's state-of-the-art that we can all share and build off that one, from my perspective.
Chief Bostrom?
And I would, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think significant progress has been made in Minneapolis. Some support toward ours would be helpful, in technology enhancements and so on. Not at a great deal of expense, but would be profoundly effective. But it also, I think, does what Dr. Osterholm was talking about, and that is that It provides instant redundancy so that if there was a problem in St. Paul, we know how to communicate, and you have an instant place that all of us know how to work and operate, and so we can transition to another site that we're all familiar with. And so I just think from a prudent standpoint, it makes sense to have the state having one and the St. Paul and Minneapolis being the other places to provide an appropriate amount of redundancy to, in fact, be able to support the whole state from those.
Thank you.
If there's nothing further, thank you for your testimony, and we'll move on to Tim Butler, St. Paul Fire Chief.
Good afternoon, Chair.
Welcome, members of the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Tim Butler, City of St. Paul Fire Chief, former Emergency Management Director for the City of St. Paul.
Please proceed.
All right. I'm here today to provide some information on the local perspective for emergency management certification and training. I'm going to talk specifically about the St. Paul perspective, but I also want to bring in the perspective of some of the outer lying areas of Minnesota and the county perspectives that are out there. And I would encourage the committee here to invite the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers to also present some information to you. They are a statewide organization designed to be provide that statewide perspective on emergency management. They represent urban as well as rural areas. So just to begin with the training requirements for local emergency management programs, the Minnesota Emergency Management Act of 1996, reflected in State Statute 12, talks about the training requirements for each political subdivision. And basically the statute says each political subdivision shall establish an emergency management program, and each county shall have a director and at least one or more deputy directors. So that's kind of the authority base for having an emergency management program. Several challenges to that mandate. There is no dedicated funding stream that goes with that mandate. Many of the emergency managers are also what I call dual-hatted. They have different responsibilities in addition to being the director of emergency management. In St. Paul, for instance, fire chief right now. In many of the county areas, they are also veteran service officers, county sheriff deputies, fire chiefs, or police chiefs. So they wear a variety of hats. They're not dedicated solely to emergency management in all cases. The state statute also does not designate or mandate any particular training or certification requirement. There is a state policy that comes out of the Public Safety Department that talks about certification, but nothing in the law. The only thing that's provided in the Minnesota Emergency Management Act is that training shall be provided sufficiently so that local political subdivisions know how to request state and federal assistance. So again, I'd go back to the Emergency Management Association Minnesota, AMEM, and talk to them about who's really doing the work out there in Minnesota and what their requirements and their workload are, because they have a statewide perspective that I don't have. Training and certification requirements set forth by the Department of Public Safety through the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management are basically set forth in the Director's Handbook, the policy manual for emergency managers in the state. And it talks about two levels of certification. If you're a political subdivision of less than 10,000 people, the emergency management certification program is 104 hours long. If you're in a political subdivision greater than 10,000 people, then there's a training and certification program of about 250, 240 hours, and that includes the University of Minnesota. Now, these classes that are held and they're orchestrated and provided by the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management by the state, they're excellent training, and they combine self-instruction, instruction. They provide web-based instruction and classroom instruction. So a combination of all of that. Now, if you're really on the ball and you really have a lot of time for from your agency to go to these trainings, you can complete the training for the Type 2 or the larger jurisdictions in about 9 months of really hard work. For old-timers like me, it took me 3 years because they didn't have the Internet and they didn't have self-study courses back when I took it. So anywhere between 9 months and a couple of years to get certified as an emergency management professional in the state of Minnesota. My professional opinion is the classroom portion of that training is essential to what we do. Emergency management basically coordinates a response to a disaster from a comprehensive point of view, from before, during, and after the incident. But we combine all these resources, these expertises, into a coordinated response. And this classroom instruction gives you a set of peers from a lot of different agencies, a lot of different perspectives, that are now the network that you reach out to and touch when you need to coordinate the response. Those are your fellow responders. So I think that classroom training is essential. There's also some federally required training, and the biggest one that you've probably heard about is the National Incident Management System. Every program is supposed to have their responders trained at certain levels of this federal program. You've probably heard about the Incident Command System, ICS. That's the component that's most robust, it's most developed. It's one that's been used in the fire and EMS and emergency management services for many years. The rest of the components of NIMS have not been developed by the federal government completely yet. So some of that is, here's what our vision is, but it isn't here yet. So that poses a challenge for us. In St. Paul, we had over 2,800 responders that had to go through this training. Not only does that put a burden on the training facilities and the trainers, but to backfill police and firefighters who are on duty and can't get away to a classroom or to an internet is a challenge for us. Seasonal employees and employee turnover on a regular basis also pose a challenge. We've been aided in a great deal by the Minnesota Division of Emergency Management, Homeland Security, and our county emergency management counterparts, because the state has developed, long before the feds mandated it, a great training program for incident command system. It's called MINIMS now, the Minnesota Incident Management System, and they have provided training to help locals like myself become a certified instructor so we can go out and train our troops on duty, and that's been a great asset. Our fellow emergency managers and other people in the public safety arena, fire, police, EMS, they've all stepped forward and shared resources for training instructors, and that's been very helpful. In regards to HSEM's assistance to locals, they do a number of great things for us, and I just want to tout their assistance. Planning assistance and coordination for didactic planning has been very good with them. They have regional program coordinators that are state officials that come out and help folks like myself coordinate our program, make sure that our plans are up to the state standards through a process called the MINWOC, the crosswalk developed in Minnesota to check your plan to make sure it meets the standard for your type of jurisdiction. They have provided a single point of contact for emergencies and emergency response called the State Duty Officer. That is a great program. I hope that the funding and resources for that always are there. It's like 911 for the state, and it's a great asset. The training and certification program run through Chris Ide's office has already been mentioned. That is, as far as I know, the only certification program that we have for emergency management, and I think that we should continue that program. And then, of course, grant funding through the Emergency Management Performance Grant and the Influenza Pandemic Planning Grant has been very helpful to the locals. Those are, in some cases, state money mandated or regulated and controlled through a state program, well regulated through the state, and in some cases, like the Influenza Pandemic Planning Grant, that was state funding that went to the locals, and that has been a great asset for us. Some initiatives in St. Paul. We've recently created a whole department of emergency management. So this year we went through the whole process of dedicating specific resources and providing statutory authority for that department. Used to be a division in the fire department. Now it's a citywide department with the same authority as the fire chief or police chief. We've created a citywide emergency management council. Like many of the emergency management programs, we've taken experts from each of the departments in the city, put them together as an operational arm of this department. It's a great leverage to the emergency management staff. And then we went through, as many jurisdictions did, a full pandemic influenza planning process where we wrote a supplement to our comprehensive emergency management plan. We held training and exercises. We got some personal protective equipment and pharmaceuticals, and we tested that plan through exercises. Some of the challenges I see at the local level for emergency management is, in my case, and I'm an army of one, no offense to the National Guard, I'm an army of one trying to do a lot of work. And I actually use that as a badge of honor, just like the Army does. We do a tough job, we do it well, and we do it with a very small amount of resources. We could use a ton more, but, you know, it's like eating an elephant. You do it one bite at a time. My message to my troops is, it's like climbing a mountain. Are you more prepared today than you were yesterday? Are you more prepared this year than last year? You're never going to get prepared for every contingency all at once. There is no way to do it. There's not enough resources or time to do it. But you got to look back a year and say, yep, we're better off than we were then. And so we're making progress. We're taking ground. We're moving forward. The cuts in LGA has been an impact on the local programs. It's been an impact on my local program. We had an envision creating this new department with a staff of five. We have a staff of one. And largely that's been because we didn't have enough local government aid and enough, quite frankly, general fund money in the city. The reason I mentioned LGA, and I don't want to, I'm not an expert on LGA, and I'm not here to ask for LGA, by the way. I'm here, though, to tell you that some of the significant reasons I see the need for state funding to local programs is we have, in the metro area specifically, St. Paul specifically, lots of state office buildings that bring in tons of state workers and tons of visitors. So the fire and police and emergency management protection for those buildings, I can count five or six buildings that have gone up in the past few years just within a couple blocks of my headquarters. We didn't get any extra to fund to protect those. In addition, those state office buildings house important programs that if there was a fire, a chlorine spill, anything like that, not only would we all be impacted right now if we had a spill outside, but all the functions that take place in these buildings would cease. And that's why I think we need those contingency planners and the resources that come with LGA. We had a state legislative initiative submitted last year through the city for a full-time planner for the state of Minnesota, not for St. Paul, but for the state of Minnesota operating out of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management to be a contingency planner for these state buildings and state infrastructure that are located in St. Paul. It's a start towards continuity and contingency planning for essential state services. The other challenge at the local level and where we could use some assistance is sustainment of a key asset that we have, and that's the 800 megahertz radio system. And we have just recently in St. Paul come onto that system. Minneapolis and Hennepin County and other areas have been on for a long time, or for a greater time. It is a superb asset. We can now talk statewide, region-wide. Fire can talk to police. They can talk to public works. It's a great asset. Each agency like mine is paying for the use of that system every year per radio, a user's fee. And if the state could somehow find a way to pay for that for us, we'd operate it, we'd use it, we'd save lives with it, but I can't pay $40,000 or $50,000 per year to make that happen in St. Paul. I'll have to find the money, but I'm not here asking for money. I'm just telling you what the just telling you what the challenges I face are. Four other legislative initiatives I think could be helpful, and I'm going to speak a little bit out of turn, but I'm going to speak on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers and at least the things I see coming for us. And I won't bore you with the details, but I have some bullet points if you want to ask some follow-on questions. But individual and family preparedness. We can make our responders as prepared as possible, but we're never going to reach everybody unless we have a public awareness campaign that is sustained long-term in the state. The State Department of Health was given a grant last year for $500,000, did great work with the locals to get a system going, and now there's no money to sustain it except federal money that we could be using for other Homeland Security and emergency management needs. So I'd really encourage the look at sustainment of that Code Ready program. The Disaster Contingency Fund has been talked about at the state legislature before. This is a fund of money that would allow local jurisdictions to recoup some of the uninsured losses that they incur during disasters where it doesn't meet the threshold for presidential declaration. There's a program called Emergency Management Program Performance Grant, EMPG. You're going to hear that acronym a lot because the Bush administration is proposing for 2009 to cut that out of the budget. This is a federal funding source that comes to the state, well managed by our people in the state, and it goes directly to counties to support daily activity in emergency management. The stuff that normally happens, winter awareness campaign, severe weather campaign, maintenance of your training and contingency planning efforts. And without that much of the work wouldn't get done. And then the last pitch I'll make for AMEM and the emergency management directors is dedicated full-time emergency managers. We don't need dual-hatted people. We don't need veteran service officers and emergency managers doing two or three roles. This is a professional career path. It's a professional need out there. It's a special slice of public safety. Took me as a firefighter, made me an emergency manager. It's a lot better if we train emergency managers to be those professionals because they have a different perspective than fire or police. So dedicated emergency management directors would be a very big help. And I'll entertain any questions, and I'm sorry I took too long.
Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Chief Butler, you talked about the EMPGs and that the feds are going to try to cut those grants. Is that what I, did I hear that or did I dream that?
And it's just been recent. Yes, Senator Higgins, thanks for your question. The proposal in the 2009 federal budget that President Bush is putting forward is that EMPG funding for that program would be eliminated. In the past, they've talked about scaling it back. They've talked about expanding it. But this time, they're recommending, or the president's proposing, that it be eliminated completely.
And Mr. Chair, Chief Butler, do you know, probably not, offhand, how much money comes into Minnesota through that grant program?
Senator Higgins, I don't know that.
Okay.
I'm sure our contacts at the State Homeland Security Division would know that for sure.
Okay.
Senator Bonner.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the work you're doing. I really appreciate that. I spent some time talking to the police chief of Plymouth about this area. He's very involved in emergency preparedness, and he talks about the importance of working regionally on emergency preparedness. And so I know that you do have this process in place. Can you say a little bit about that, how there's regional centers around the state working on emergency preparedness and your relationship to each other?
Right. Thanks for the good question. Regionalization and partnering with other agencies is probably the most important asset that we have. There's no way we could do this work if we all had to do everything. So we do share assets. We do share funding. We share resources. And a couple ways that happens. In the metro area, we have several regional bodies that are working to coordinate grants, to coordinate equipment purchasing, standardizing of EOC protocols for communication transfer. Those are the Urban Area Securities Initiative. You might hear that acronym UASI thrown out there. That's a great regional body composed primarily of Minneapolis, St. Paul, the state of Minnesota, Ramsey, Dakota, and Hennepin County. That's the kind of the core group. There's another little bit larger metropolitan group that's 10 counties and the two cities of the first class, including the U of M and the airport, and that's a regional body that we basically came up with a joint powers agreement to share resources and planning and coordinate in conjunction with each other. And that was originally motivated by the state providing the metro region with a $500,000 planning grant, provided we all work together to figure out how we're going to spend it and share it. And we did that in the metro area. And there are six of those regions, emergency management regions, around the state. The metro region is number six, so please remember that, number six. So that's great. Working as well. And then the state also provides assistance through those grants, and this year in 2007, a competitive grant between those emergency management regions, again with the stipulation, here's a regional allocation or a grant. Please work together to coordinate planning, training, equipment, and those kind of things.
Thank you.
Representative Dela Forest.
Chairman, thank you. Chief, as I try to wrap my arms around this, of course, we're dealing with all sorts of nightmare scenarios where we contemplate mutual aid, things that no one jurisdiction can handle on their own. And you had mentioned UASI and some other things. Is there one clearinghouse or body that's coordinating these kind of things that talks and says, are the Minneapolis SOPs similar to St. Paul's SOPs, similar to White Bear Lake's SOPs in dealing with these things? It shifts, and it was kind of, I think Chief Forday mentioned, that there's sort of a shifting criteria even for who's in charge of a disaster, which I can understand that, but it strikes me as a little counterintuitive. It's like the National Guard saying, well, once the bullets start flying, we'll decide who's going to be in charge of the unit. And maybe that's the best way to go, but is there a body that's coordinating all these things, or says that, you know, Minneapolis has a particular high-dollar asset, does that mean St. Paul needs one? It's difficult, I understand, to try to get sort of this Tower of Babel to all talk to each other, and the 800 megahertz is just one example of trying to get a commonality and interoperability. So do you have a body, I guess the short way of asking this what's become a politician's question, and do you have one body that encompasses all these jurisdictions and all these cross disciplines and is a single clearinghouse to at least talk to each other and explore these issues of who has what and how do we talk to each other if doomsday comes?
Well, that's a good question, sir, and I'm not sure that I'm the best qualified to answer it, but I know the State Homeland Security and Emergency Management Division provides that coordination statewide. And they do the assistance that I talked about, planning, coordination, grant administration. Through those regional program coordinators, we have a person assigned to the metro region from that state division that works with us to help make sure that integration happens. Most of the integration seems to me to be happening at the Urban Area Securities Initiative level, at the regional working groups and committees that are working to make that happen. The governor does have a senior advisory council on homeland security and emergency management. There's a couple. I know that Mr. Forte is involved in that, and Director Ide is involved in that. And they also provide that kind of, are we all playing together? Are we all kind of going down the same strategic planning process? In regards to the actual management of an incident, we don't have one person that's in charge of the whole state or all the resources there. We have a management system built around management by objectives called the Incident Command System. And the reason there's different people that are in charge of that incident is because there's different objectives taking place at the incident. So first, for a building collapse, for instance, we go through a rescue where maybe fire or search and rescue officials are in charge of that, and then maybe it would go to a public works, so you'd pass command to that. So it's an evolving state of a management system. It's not necessarily fluctuating or uncertain. It's pretty clear cut if the practitioners follow that example.
Representative Dela,
Mr. Chairman, thank you. If I just follow up, for example, another question I had. Do you know what everybody else has? I mean, does St. Paul know what Minneapolis has in terms of equipment that could be used? And of course, the goal is to not try and find these things out as the emergency's happening, to know, for example, that Minneapolis might have a piece of equipment that's needed. I'm just wondering, again, is there a clearinghouse? Do we know, are we comfortable that every municipality and county in the metro area has got a handle on who's got what in terms of sharing assets?
Mr. Forte.
Mr. Chair, if I may, through the state preparedness report, we are identifying what the resources are throughout the state and what the gaps are. Quite frankly, through the fire department, which has had mutual aid longer than any other disciplines have, we've identified what resources are through the state, duty officer, we can call and access those resources. We obviously need to build on that for the other disciplines. But the incident management system tied to the state, quite frankly, duty officer, allows us to identify what the issue is, what the problem is, who's in charge, and then we can start looking at where the assets are and moving them forward. One step I think we've taken in the last 4 or 5 years is the state actually has the response teams, the collapse structure, the hazmat teams and bomb squads, so we can move those resources throughout the state as needed. I think we have a better, in fact, I know we do, the National Response Report Card shows that the city of Minneapolis and the state are way above most cities and states in this area. You can tell by the bridge collapse, the response to that, we shared assets there that have never been shared in the state before. So again, I think the key is that we train everybody throughout the state in the National Incident Management System, and we work with our state preparedness report to identify where the gaps are and where the equipment is. But we do have programs set up to do that.
Mr. Chairman, if I just wanted to comment, Chief, I appreciate the comment. At least for me, as a policymaker, that I think that's a fundamental question for this group is how much commonality and interoperability is there? How much maybe should there be? But that's what's important, because again, we contemplate scenarios that are requiring jurisdictions to share assets all the time. I don't think we contemplate any kind of scenario, once again, unfortunately, where, yes, St. Paul can handle it, we'll just turn the lights off. We're going to have to share, and it's going to be it's a three-dimensional kind of thing, if you will, and that's what I want to know. For example, the UASIA, you mentioned some counties, Chief, and I don't think I heard Anoka County in there for whatever reason. That doesn't make sense to me to have a clearinghouse or coordinating body where some jurisdictions aren't there for whatever reason. It seems to me that even if we need to be directive, there ought to be at least at some level of commonality, again, of SOPs and other things so everybody knows. So again, if there's an incident, we're not trying to make things up as we go along. And, it's enough of a burden, as you know, to respond to these things without having to wonder, well, geez, where is this, where is that? So that I hope we can address that, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair, as we go along. It seems to me it's a fundamental question.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Chief Butler, I have one question, and that is, in our last meeting, we discussed whether the HSEM certification should be a requirement for state agencies' emergency management personnel. Any comment about requiring that certification at the local level?
At the local level?
Mm-hmm.
I think anybody that's involved in emergency management, a program direction should go through that training certification. At the state agencies, I'm not really qualified to talk about them, but I would say if you're a state agency and you're the designated emergency manager, my professional opinion would be that would be a good idea.
Senator Higgins, you said that it is required for local jurisdictions, but not state.
I believe that's correct. Isn't that correct? I think that's what Matt Bostrom told us at the beginning of the meeting, was that the local jurisdictions have to be certified. Am I wrong?
I don't believe at this point in time anybody has to be certified.
Oh,
it's
right.
It's not mandatory. From my perspective, it should be.
I guess the comment I would have is that it seems to me that the theme that we've heard running through a lot of the testimony is the importance of building relationships in order to be successful, and that so much of this depends on the initiative of local units of government or the agencies responsible for doing this, and that if they are working together in a professional way, in a professional network, the response is much better. And I believe your testimony was that the classroom element of the training and certification process is essential for doing that. So do you have an idea of whether, would it be a great burden to require local units of government to be certified in this?
Well, Mr. Chair, just to clarify, there's no state mandate through the state legislature to make that happen. There's nothing that says, for instance, myself as the director of the emergency management program at St. Paul, I have to be certified, except it is a program requirement through the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management to receive those EMPG funds. So one of the elements of EMPG qualification is you have to have your emergency management staff either certified or working towards that state certification. Now, EMPG funding, I don't believe, goes to state agencies, but it does go to local jurisdictions. I mean, it does go to political subdivisions.
Dr. Osterholm.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just to get back to a point that Representative De La Forest raised, which I think was a very key one, is this issue about do we have the ability to share in knowing what we have to share? And I guess it goes back to the issue of training. How often after major events do we actually do a program review or a scrub of the situation to figure out what went right, what went wrong? Did we know about something that we could have had or didn't have, and we should have had, or we thought we had it and we didn't type thing? And actually incorporate that back into the formal training, because I think in the end those are by far some of the most instructive events. It's one thing to learn in the classroom, it's another thing to actually go back and resurrect what happened. And I don't know, I mean, this is a question really from possibly you, Chief, and also for you, just how often that happens or what happened, by the way.
Chief Butler.
Anytime we have a, Doctor, thanks for the question. Anytime we have an exercise or a training evolution in emergency management, we roll those lessons learned back into our plan. We look at the plan and say, did it work? Did the people have the training and the equipment necessary to carry that out? Or do we need to modify that training practice? One of the things Minnesota has always done, at least in the last decade or so, is they've had a after-action report corrective action plan format that we could follow at the local level. And this captured the lessons learned, talks about the areas of your plan and personnel that you tested, and then the important part, the corrective action plan, what are you going to do about it? So you found a deficit, what are you going to do about it? Recently, the Department of Homeland Security at the federal level mandated a system like that called HCEP, Homeland Security Exercise Evaluation Program. They basically took the Minnesota-type after-action report corrective action plan and incorporated it so that now if you expend Homeland Security funds for training and exercising, you have to use that plan. So I think Minnesota was on the cutting edge of that. Maybe
can
other areas
can I just
of the
ask for clarification, Mr. Chair? I guess what I'm asking is not the exercise. I think that's great, and I'm talking about the real-life events.
Right.
So, for example, when you have one event, at what point does it rise to the level of this would be one that we should actually go back and do an after-action report on and then share that across to agencies, et cetera, as opposed to the exercise, which I understand and I appreciate that. But do we actually take the events, like the 35W bridge collapse, is there a formal process to go back and do that scrub? Is there a scrub going on in the southeastern Minnesota flood issue? Is there, you know, these kinds of events where basically we can learn from them so that not only is it just the response, but in some cases, what were the institutional infrastructure pieces that weren't there to begin with that might have mitigated the very event from happening or at least reduced its impact? And so this is bigger than an exercise piece I'm really looking for or looking at. I don't know. That's where I'm wondering where we're at in that.
That's a good question, Doctor. I think many of the local jurisdictions have done that already. I know that I participated in several of Minneapolis's after-action reports regarding the 35W bridge collapse. The state has done a number of after-action reports. In fact, next week they have one scheduled for the southeast Minnesota flood response, and they've done it from different perspectives. So they're bringing in the local perspective, the state perspective. We used the same thing in St. Paul when we had a $1 million storm event this summer during the 35 bridge collapse, and we had our after-action report for the 35 bridge collapse, this severe weather event, and the response that the St. Paul had to the southeast Minnesota flood event. We had after-action reports on all three of those. So it's not a mandated part of the program from my understanding, but I think progressive emergency managers that are trying to do the right things with limited resources try to use that format.
Mr. Chair, I think that goes right to your point. That's hopefully where that comes in, is that being coordinated or planned, or did people not know about some piece of equipment they could or should have had? I mean, I assume that's what's coming through in that, I would hope, which is great. I mean, I congratulate you for that kind of activity.
The federal government, too, has set up a responder knowledge base. It's a web-based program where you can load that, and I think the Homeland Security Exercise Evaluation Program will follow a similar thing, where you can file your after-action reports on that website so that other people that are either contemplating that type of an exercise or having that kind of an event can look at lessons learned from everyone else. So the lessons learned information sharing website by the feds is one attempt to standardize that kind of across the nation.
Mr. Chair, is that a public website that any of us could go look at?
Senator Higgins, I think it's a public website that if you had a tie to Homeland Security Emergency Management interest that you could sign up, and basically your supervisor, your program director at the state would vouch that, yes, you're indeed an employee, and then you could be given a password and a username and go on that. Now, would they allow members of the legislature? I think we could probably make that happen.
I hope not.
Only if you promise to learn and share information. I think that I'm not sure the exact requirements of it, but it's primarily based towards first response agencies. But anybody with that tie, where a public agency would vouch and say, yes, they're on the team, they should have the access to this knowledge, that can happen.
Chief Butler, I guess I have one final question. You did raise the issue of funding, and so you'll be punished for that.
By many people, I'm sure.
I guess the question is, is the city of St. Paul able to find adequate resources to get ready for the summer, or is there federal money coming in as a supplement to St. Paul's ordinary budget as a result of lack of LGA, or is there some other way that you're dealing with the financial need that's caused by the Republican convention?
Well, I think as far as the Republican National Convention, I'd ask Matt Bostrom to come back and talk about that funding stream, because I know the public safety allocation is out there, but it hasn't been approved yet. So we're kind of eating the preparations from our general fund budget. As far as maximizing and leveraging scarce resources, I look at it in a couple of perspectives. The first and best way that we can do that is through our partnerships. Our sharing of regional assets and regional planning initiatives. Those things are key. And quite frankly, if all the funding went away tomorrow, they're the people I'm going to call anyway during a disaster. So I want that to be there whether the funding's there or not. But that's a great way to leverage the money that's out there. The second way is to continue to be competitive on the federal competitive grant cycle and try to get that those federal grants as best we can. And that calls for clear identification of where we need to be. The federal priorities kind of say that, the target capabilities list, the state preparedness statement are all ways of saying, here's where we should be, here's where we are. How do we fill that gap? Partnerships and regionalization, and certainly funding go a long ways to doing that. But I kind of take a step back from all of that and say, if you didn't give me anything, if my city didn't give me anything, I'm still going back to the formula. Am I more prepared today than yesterday? There are things I can do that don't cost money. Teamwork is priceless, and it doesn't cost anything. So those kind of things really help out.
Thank you. And we are at our next meeting on December 17th, next Monday, we will be looking at state and local funding issues as well. I just wanted to get your perspective.
Okay. Will we talk about EMPG? Will we talk about that next week?
Yes, in fact. Well, I don't know if that specific topic is on the agenda, okay. But I think it will be questions that will come up, and federal funding is part of our general agenda, so I think that will be part of it.
Okay. Thank you.
Is there any further questions? None? Thank you for your testimony. And we will move on to the Minnesota Higher Education Emergency Management Training and Response. We have four testifiers on the agenda, starting with Alan Johnson. And I know that, I don't know how this cuts, you're from the academic world, and I know that you're probably, however, not used to lecturing in 50-minute increments, so it will be maybe easier for you to stick to a 3 to 5 minute testimony time, which will give us time for questions that might be for some other university representatives at times.
Mr. Chairman, first I'm an engineer, and Mr. Beckering is a fire chief, so we know what it means to be short and succinct here. Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for the opportunity to come here this afternoon. For the record, I'm Alan Johnson. I'm the Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities at MinSCU, and with me is Don Beckering, the State Director for the Fire, EMS, and Safety Center at MinSCU. Just by way of introduction here, I'd like to say that we're very proud of the fact that Minnesota State Colleges and Universities educates and trains 92% of the state's law enforcement officers and 9,000 firefighters and first responders each year. And that academic responsibility falls primarily on our colleges and universities around the state, and just some of them that you know very well, places like Hennepin Technical College, Minneapolis Community and Technical College, Alexandria Tech, Hibbing Community College, and there are many more. In addition, each one of our seven state universities has either a law enforcement or a criminal justice four-year baccalaureate program. I'd like to call your attention, too, to the November issue of our magazine, the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, that's been passed out at your place. It has an article on the 34W bridge collapse and our role in emergency training. As I mentioned, the actual hands-on education and training of first responders takes place on campuses through our qualified instructors and educators. The delivery of many of those academic programs is under the oversight of Mr. Beckering's office here in St. Paul. Now, there's a yin and a yang, I guess. There's another extremely important issue here, and that's ensuring that we, on the campuses, do the proper internal advance planning to enable appropriate response to a disaster. The campuses themselves face a variety of threats, and natural disasters of storms, floods, tornadoes, and of course, pandemic flu, structural issues such as chemical spills and fire, and then of course, there's the threats that we have on our mind about armed individuals resulting in the need for communications, evacuations, lockdowns, and all of which require training and practice on each individual campus. Our Board of Trustees recently directed long-term emergency planning as follows, and I'm quoting some excerpts from board policy. Each college and university shall develop and maintain an all-hazards plan. The all-hazards plan will include three sections. One, crisis intervention. Two, continuity of operations. And three, emergency preparedness. And I'd like to ask Mr. Beckering to give you some details of each of those three items as actual planning is taking place out on campuses.
Thank you, Mr. Beckering. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
I'm Don Beckering, and I'm the State Director and Manager of the Fire EMS Safety Center for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities System. And the board has tasked our center and has assigned us oversight for the preparation of all hazards planning for our 32 colleges and universities. So I work individually with each one of those campuses in the preparations that deal with emergencies at our locations and at our facilities. As Associate Vice Chancellor Johnson stated, our plan consists of three components: emergency preparedness, the crisis intervention, and continuity of operations. Our emergency preparedness section of our all-hazards plan prepares our campuses to deal with the different types of natural and accidental man-made emergencies that basically any state agency or business might encounter or face. This section we are designing to flow directly into our local, county, and state plans. So therefore, you can lay the documents side by side and start to do some very, very good analysis of who is going to be responsible for what in the event of a major emergency at our campus. Our campuses practice these things each and every year through either tabletop exercises or drills, a lot of them used in conjunction with the local community, where they participate as a drill site, or they participate in the parts that they play in that local response. All of our plans are going to be currently going through an update or revision based off of the new requirements that are there under the National Response Plan, and also going back to the Governor's Executive Order 0714, dealing with state agencies and their responses. So all of our plans will be updated. Crisis intervention for all of our plans are being prepared to deal with the more the intentional man-made incidences that may occur. Crisis intervention for us came into a lot stronger focus after the unfortunate event at Virginia Tech. Even though our emergency preparedness section dealt with most of the issues of crisis intervention, we felt that we needed to put something together to enhance or reinforce what we now do and strengthen what we have. And so our center put together a planning guide for our campuses to use to basically enhance that component, making them stronger in this whole area of crisis intervention and dealing with such things as shooters on campus, lockdown, and those types of things. And our goal is, again, to have tested plans in place and ready to go by the end of 2008. The last section of our plan deals with continuity of operations. And basically that is to help our campuses recover from a major emergency that may happen on campus or in some cases in a local community and be able to get back to our mission, which is educating Minnesota, as quickly and as efficiently as possible. All of our colleges and universities are deep into this planning process of current time. All of them have pretty much put together their operational impact analysis and are starting to put together a lot of the recovery strategies that they have. And again, our tentative goal is to have all these plans in place by the end of 2008. We know the importance of having trained first responders at all levels of response, but particularly at the local level. It's very, very critical for us, being that our campuses are local-based. And so we rely quite heavily on our local responders to help us. And this has been our mission for many, many years. As Associate Vice Chancellor Johnson pointed out, we prepare most of the first responders in the state in this whole area of all hazards. And we know that this training benefits the entire state. We tap that at the local level as we do our planning. And we ask our local community emergency responders to help us and give us that expertise. And so we utilize those in the planning process, and in particular the evaluation and testing of our plans. And that feedback is very, very important for us. So, for example, the Coon Rapids Police and Fire Departments observed a recent evacuation drill that we had at Anoka Ramsey Community College. The observers commented on the effectiveness of the drill and how well organized it was. We got a very complimentary email from the Wilmer Fire Chief who observed a fire drill at our Wilmer campus at Ridgewater College. Again, really commenting on the efficiency that our campuses are now showing in this whole area of fire drills and fire activities. As I said, many of our campuses also serve in the local emergency response plans. Our Hutchinson campus of Ridgewater College recently participated in a pandemic exercise with their local community where they serve as an inoculation site for those counties. Again, they actually bust a whole bunch of people in. We charted out the routes through the campus to maintain security, and again, went extremely well as a drill can go. Many of you may have followed or heard about our mercury spill that we had at Minnesota State University Moorhead a few months ago. And in my discussions with the Moorhead Public Safety, Clay County Public Health, and other state officials, the response went extremely well. In talking to Bay West, who was our cleanup contractor, it was one of the most well-organized responses to a dangerous situation that they had ever experienced, and they do a lot of this type of response. We assessed over 100 people for exposures, decontaminated possible victims, cleaned up the site, and got the campus back up and running in 24 hours, which is extremely, extremely efficient. Again, I want all of you to know that the Minnesota State College University is working very, very hard to keep our students, staff, and visitors to our campuses safe in the event of any kind of emergency. And I'll entertain any questions that the committee may have.
Questions? I have one question, and that is, you mentioned the mercury spill, and previously we heard from Mr. Forte about the University of Minnesota lab that was next to the 35W bridge collapse site. Is identification and communication of places where hazardous substances may be on your various campuses part of the emergency planning that you do with the local authorities?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is part of what we do. We try and coordinate that. We invite all first responders to get on campus, to do tours of the campus, to find out where the hazardous materials are located, along with the haz waste materials that might be there each and every year. We know our programs do change. We add new programs which create new hazards, and because of that, that invitation is there for local police, fire, emergency management to come on site on an annual basis.
No further questions? I guess we'll move on to the University of Minnesota. Looks like Chief Hessness and Lance Ross.
Yes. Okay, well, I actually have prepared one of these little flash drive presents. Do you want to go through with that, or should we talk it through?
It's your pleasure,
okay.
Chief.
All right.
If you can make it work.
I'm planning on help here.
He's a high-tech kind of guy. Otherwise, Alice.
those all.
Oh, sure you are. Okay. Hey, great. It's about the fourth time I've ever done this.
Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Absolutely. Good afternoon. I'm Greg Hesnes. I'm the Assistant Vice President for Public Safety and the Police Chief at the University of Minnesota.
And I'm Lance Ross, Assistant Director of Emergency Management at the U of M.
Okay. So thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about public safety and our emergency management program at the University of Minnesota. I've been serving in this role at the university since August 2003, and I got this invitation Friday afternoon, so I hope I'm on point for what you were interested in knowing about, but there's been a tremendous amount, as you heard, of interest in emergency management, so I've had a little bit in the can for you. There we go. So, University of Minnesota has been involved in emergency planning since back to the days of civil defense. But in the last decade, of course, of things like Oklahoma City, September 11th, Virginia Tech this year, and then our own bridge collapse, there's been a lot more emphasis on campus safety and preparedness. And the university has really undergone some major transformations in the last 5 years in this regard. Okay, I want to back up one. Okay, you probably know, but the University of Minnesota actually has almost 51,000 students on the Twin Cities campus this year. We're typically tied with Ohio State and the University of Texas at Austin is the second largest enrollment in the country. Generally, Arizona is quite a bit ahead of us. We figure there's probably 80,000 visitors, students, faculty, staff, patients on campus on most days, about 270 buildings, and we're substantially located in the city of Minneapolis, Falcon Heights, and St. Paul. All right. Department of Public Safety at the University of Minnesota actually consists of three departments. The University of Minnesota Police Department serves the Twin Cities campus, but we provide occasional support and advice to the University of Minnesota Duluth and Morris Police Department campuses. Emergency management and central security serve system-wide, so both on the Twin Cities campus and throughout the coordinate campuses. Although all three DPS departments are involved in emergency management preparedness. Emergency management, and Lance is the assistant director here, has four certified emergency managers, the director, Lance, and two others. They're involved in preparedness, which is maintaining our emergency operations plan, emergency responses, things that will open our emergency operations center and staff that in the event of emergencies on campus. And they are also involved in the development of continuity of operations plans for the various units at the university. Emergency management at the university is dedicated to helping the university and the state of Minnesota prepare for, respond to, and recover from, and reduce the effects of intentional, accidental, or natural disasters. University of Minnesota Police Department has existed on campus for over 70 years. We place a great amount of emphasis on partnerships, both on and off campus. And as has been mentioned a couple of times here today, with our regional 800 megahertz radio system. And we also share a computer-aided dispatch system with the city of Minneapolis. We provide quite a bit of support in the broader campus area off campus. And finally, is the Department of Central Security. They provide monitoring and installation of about 1,100 continuously monitored and recorded surveillance cameras on campus for one. And that's throughout the system at Morris Duluth as well. Intercoms in the lobbies, we control access electronically to about 1,000 doors and about 120 buildings, and that's growing. And that is the standard as we do new projects or we do major remodelings.
And that access control and the camera systems are very important to us, both in case of emergency, just for routine police operations. You probably saw a couple times this year we had an individual on campus who was bent on abducting a young woman, in fact, twice, at first at University Village, and then this fall at Wilson Library. He convinced the young woman to accompany him to a remote part of the library and attempt to abduct her. Well, we had him on surveillance both occasions. In fact, we know him. It's Matthew Pengra. And we had him identified and charged shortly after that. So very important for safety on the campus. The Academic Health Center, as Dr. Osterholm represents, is another very important component to emergency preparedness on campus. When we talk about academic health, you know, it's the seven, I can almost always quote these, the seven medical schools, university, medicine, nursing, dentistry, pharmacy, public health, veterinary, and the UMD medical school as well. So they are very much integrated into emergency planning, both on campus and in the state. They have accepted a role in mass dispensing in the event of a pan flu, other expertise. In fact, the medical response corps accompanied the Mayo Clinic and some of our emergency managers down to Katrina last year and provided support really on a national basis, and they are quite a resource to both the university and the state of Minnesota. The University of Minnesota, the mission of our emergency plan is, of course, to protect life and property. By that, we mean animal life as well as human life, to secure our critical infrastructure and facilities. Protecting property includes both our real property and intellectual properties, which have been subject to attack, and to resume teaching at the university as soon as possible. Some of our priorities of the plan, I won't go into tremendous detail on this, but of course, it's areas used by dependent populations. That we mean we have a lot of students that live on campus, we have patients at the hospital, and frankly, we have a lot of animals who live on campus. So protection of life is our first priority in our emergency plan. It kind of cascades down from there. As others have mentioned, we do have an all-hazard incident command system. And as was mentioned, incident command came out of the fire service about 40 years ago during the wildfires in California, when a lot of agencies had to learn to work together on a really big problem. So that were the origins of NIMS, and that brought together diverse agencies into an effective single response to a major emergency. The university emergency operations plan is coordinated with local, state, and federal plans for assistance. Over the last 5 years, we've trained, done exercises, and deployed as well with local, state, and federal partners. Some of the things you might expect we could end up responding to, any number of potential emergencies from simple personal events to campus-wide and beyond, things like the bridge collapse and the planning we've done for pandemic flu. So we do work to anticipate all potential hazards, including violent criminal acts, as we've seen very recently. The focus of our plan, as has been mentioned as well, I don't have to dwell on these, they've been said once or twice already, controlling risk, risk mitigation, managing an incident, and reestablishing the work of the U operational continuity after the fact. In terms of risk mitigation, what are we doing along those lines? As I mentioned, the creation of the Office of Central Security in 2002 has contributed in many ways, both in control and emergencies, follow-up to criminal investigations. Actually, our monitors have intervened in situations when they've actually seen a problem or a crime in progress and alerted police to that. Externally, we've been audited in a good way by the Minnesota National Guard on a number of occasions, including things like our buffer zone protection program, evaluated the security of our major venues like Williams Arena and Mariucci and the like. So that's pretty much ongoing. The Academic Health Center Regulatory Affairs make sure that we're in compliance with all of our research and hazardous material requirements. Emergency response and incident management at the university. Our emergency operations plan guides response to major emergencies on campus, conforms with the state homeland security and emergency management planning requirements, outlines the responsibilities of our key departments during emergency, and establishes a chain of command for decision making during and after an emergency. With regard to operational continuity planning, that's a responsibility of the Department of Emergency Management to assist our departments in having plans for restoration of operations as soon as possible after an emergency. Right now, there are 17 departments at the university that are considered to be critical to our operation. Obviously, facilities, police, all sorts of things, but many in the Academic Health Center as well. Academic Health Center and Emergency Management have worked together extensively on an operational continuity plan associated with pandemic flu. NIMS has been mentioned any number of times today. The Homeland Security Presidential Directive did direct that local units of government will become compliant with NIMS. It was adopted by the state of Minnesota, and in May of 2005, also adopted by the University of Minnesota. We've been actively training and exercising it since that time. The incorporation of NIMS is really a significant factor in our ability to respond to the 35W bridge collapses effectively, as everyone did. The basic command structure for the university in the event of emergency is also compliance with NIMS. We have an officer of the day named, and presumptively that officer of the day is my boss, Vice President Kathy O'Brien, who's responsible for university services, the facilities, the police, most of the basic operations. And there are five deep in that backup. I am the fifth of the five, so we probably won't get there, but the top leadership of the university have been required to take NIMS training so that they're prepared and tested to lead the university through an emergency. Some of our strategies to strengthen emergency efforts on the university campus included, first of all, rewriting our emergency operations plan. There was one that people worked very hard on, but was not NIMS compliant, was not usable and understandable and compartmentalizable for others to work with. It was also a requirement for us to be eligible for any emergency funding through the state and federal government, so we have achieved that. An example of that really important is to help fund our migration to 800 megahertz, which has been very important to us. Preparing for emergencies, certainly on college campuses this year, communications has been, since Virginia Tech in particular, has been a really critical discussion. How well are we prepared to communicate in an emergency? We've recently added the text messaging capabilities. We've got about 9,000 voluntary students signed up for that. Prior to that, our main venues were use of email, voicemail alerts, that sort of thing. The emails were not particularly satisfactory. That's been streamlined. We can push out about 10,000 in 10 minutes now. And then the tone alert radios. They're like a weather radio. We've got about 400 of them out. They're stationed in high traffic areas of buildings. They've been out there for about 5 years. It wasn't a particularly well-managed program. These guys are taking the inventory and making sure that they're all up to speed in terms of their battery capabilities and that the people who work, there's been a lot of turnover at the university in 5 years, as there always is, that people know what they're about. We had people putting them in drawers and disconnecting them and not wanting to hear that tone go off for its monthly alert. So we're working to improve that. And lastly, we need to have good policy. Well, the next leg here, we're investigating public address systems for our campus. This is out of a state of Florida governor's study, and that is the fourth element we'd like to add. The University of Iowa at Iowa City just added those, and they're getting pretty good results. So that'll be the next place we're going. And then finally, we've got to have proper policies so that the people know how to activate the system and have the authority to do that at the right level of authority. So if we have a police sergeant at 3 in the morning that's responding to an active shooter and needs to get that message out, they know how to do so. Our training plans, you've heard that discussed as well today. We do have a multi-year training plan to provide training to the right people at the right levels they need. Those who are required to be NIMS certified are getting the training, taking the tests, and achieving certification. Those who need just knowledge and familiarity, like our deans, are getting that. And actually, the Board of Regents has requested and been briefed both on public safety in general and our emergency preparedness plans. We also serve the coordinate campuses. Our Twin Cities plan has served as a template for the coordinates. We're working with the coordinates to develop their operational continuity plans. Again, of course, we're talking about Morris, Crookston, Duluth, and now Rochester's on the horizon as well. So that is on our radar. Details of each plan are going to vary somewhat with the assets, resources, and partnerships out there, but we have one of our emergency management staff who's dedicated to working with the coordinates, and she is out there working with Stevens County and Polk County and St. Louis County to make sure everybody can work together. When you look at Morris, let me say, the Morris Police Department with 7 officers is the largest agency in the county. That's followed by the sheriff's office with 5 deputies, and that's followed by the campus police with 3 officers. So clearly people have to work together in those communities. So implementing our emergency response plan has actually happened a number of times in recent days. As we mentioned, the university property near the bridge, as it happened, 11 of our officers were first responders to the north end of the bridge on duty that day. Actively involved in rescue. By the end of the night, 35 of our 47 officers were in and working on the bridge response. Picture in the truck you'll see there is Officer Ryan Rivers, one of our UMPD canine handlers, who was busy pressing a pickup truck into service as an emergency rescue vehicle, and we'd run short of ambulances. So key factors in the effectiveness of that response, I would have to say, were 1, our NIMS training. We knew how to work as a component. 800 megahertz radio system, which has been launched in Hennepin County for some time, about to go countywide in Ramsey. And just frankly, the local Minnesota tradition of working together at the state, federal, and local levels without turf battles or ego issues. We know each other well and we work well effectively, I think. As you can see, just the relationships here today. So the University Police Department, the public safety, worked well under a unified command system. Now, here's what I'm going to try to get right. Let me show you if I can do this. I don't know if I can or not. We divided our areas of responsibility up into command zones. I don't know if I'm able to do this. I can't see how it works on this. Okay, how's my pointer options? Oh, gosh. Okay. Okay, the 35W is a primary responsibility of the State Patrol, secondarily the Minneapolis Police. The Mississippi River site was predominantly the responsibility of the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office, and Minneapolis Park Police were the backups to that. University of Minnesota, obviously our police department, was responsible for our properties, with Minneapolis as our backup. And the West River Road, predominantly the Minneapolis Park Police, secondarily Minneapolis. In the rail yards, there is a Burlington Northern Police Agency, secondarily Minneapolis. And then 2nd Street Southeast is predominantly the responsibility of the Minneapolis Police Department. And since I got the slide from Rob Allen in Minneapolis, he makes the Minneapolis Police go real big. So that worked well for us. Additionally, we actually have received a mobile command post that was underutilized in another part of the state, but has not been underutilized at the university. We've made very good use for that, and that was actually our base of operations on the north end of the bridge collapse that day. Bomb threats. We've had 5 bomb threats at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus since the Virginia Tech incident. The first was 2 days afterwards. One was a note that was posted. 3 have been emailed, and 1 came in through Minneapolis 911 just this past week. Our deputy chief, who's been there for 30 years, says he hasn't seen this in 12 years, but it's obviously back in vogue. The emails in particular are pretty difficult to gauge their credibility, but to this point, we've pretty much erred on the side of student safety, evacuated, done the searches. We're getting a little more effective at returning to the use of the building afterwards, but it is in vogue, unfortunately, and we've had to learn some lessons from that each time. The text view, the texting system we just put in place a couple weeks ago, actually we used this year with the threat at Wiley Hall, which adjoins the law school, so we had a double issue with that. Our university buildings are varied and unique. We have classrooms, laboratories, clinics, residence halls. It really each requires different tactics. A couple of these cases are actively under investigation with some potential leads to work. So we've talked a little bit about Columbine. We've talked a little about Virginia Tech. And just like Omaha last week, in the Twin Cities campus of the University of Minnesota is by design, a very large public space where we invite and want people to come and make use of the facilities and attend athletic events, but it makes it that much more difficult to shut it down in short order. After Columbine, law enforcement generally, and campus law enforcement in particular, took a real hard look at our tactics. Essentially, what happened at Columbine was the officers did what they were taught. And the teaching at the time was contain a situation, call in the better, higher assets, the SWAT team and the like. Unfortunately, in some of those situations, like Columbine or Red Lake or Virginia Tech, in the meantime, people did continue to be shot and killed. So we've taught officers, just regular officers, not SWAT team officers, that in an emergency, they may need to quickly form an entry team, provided them some rudimentary entry searching techniques, because sometimes you just have to go to the sound of the shots and try to stop the harm. So not ideal, but that's something we've accepted. Another thing I would mention was also touched on is I brought crisis intervention team training to the university. It was a program we had at the city of Minneapolis where our officers are provided a 40-hour curriculum that really gives them a lot more information about mental health issues, what works, what doesn't work, and to make sure that we can probably do a better job of early intervention when students might be having some difficulties. On a huge campus like the University of Minnesota, and we talk with our peers at other institutions, it's a lot easier for somebody with emotional difficulties to kind of fly under the radar. You know, on a St. Olaf campus where one of my daughters went versus the Twin Cities campus where my other daughter and I attended, it's a lot easier to be anonymous. So what we've created is a Provost Committee on Student Mental Health. That's been in effect the last 3 years to improve services, to make sure faculty knows they have a role if they identify students that are in obviously some amount of difficulty. And then just recently we've created something that was informally done before known as the BIT team or Behavior Intervention Team. So that's typically police, student affairs, point and health service, maybe housing and residential life. Anybody that becomes aware that students may be having some difficulties. Unfortunately, I've got to say we're actually using this with some regularity. So. But better to get students the help they need before they, you know, reach a crisis point. Okay. So, on an ongoing basis, you've mentioned after-action reports. We always do those. These guys are responsible for doing an after-action report, both after training exercise or after an actual incident. We've used them for bomb threats. We've used them for the Smith Hall chemical fire. We had a fire at the steam plant that was. Could have shut down heating at the university in November, which would have been really bad. So campus-wide, we're completing our communications plans, as I discussed. We participate in internal and external emergency management exercises. And preparing for the future, our goal, and I think we've made some progress in doing this, is that the university is not just a risk and a liability, that we're actually an asset there, as we always have been. Things like academic health being involved in pan flu preparedness to be part of the state response, and just a little bit that maybe the university police can do at a bridge response, etc., to make sure we're contributing our assets as best we can. That's it. That was the quick and short of it. So, questions for you from the committee?
Questions? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Chief. If the university population had to be evacuated in total, I didn't hear anything about that in your presentation, but do you have plans on how to do that? Is the student population aware of that potentiality?
You know, it would just be following the state plan. I mean, it's kind of like evacuating Bloomington. I mean, it really is that many people. And so it'd be very much human. We have our notification system. And I forgot to say that we'll never get away from just face-to-face with police officers and facilities management staff giving direction, but it would be, you know, turning roads, going out, that sort of thing.
Thank you. For the purposes of the committee, maybe one of the future hearings should be about how we evacuate regions of the state, like the entire Twin City area. How could that happen? How would it work if there was an emergency of that magnitude? I, as an average citizen, don't know where I would go. We'd all be running around in circles. So I don't think the population is aware of it. And if the there's some public officials that know about it, I certainly don't. I don't think any of my neighbors do either.
Mr. Ross. Senator Lemer and members of the committee, MnDOT has been working on some plans with local officials, part of that networking and working together relationship-wise. The U of M is actually, it's either the third largest geographical area for people in a setting to that evacuate every day, leaving work and coming to work. And there's actually some plans that identifies what roads we'll need to utilize, as well as even to the point where what type of equipment we could put there, whether it's dump trucks if we need to, or barricades, or whatever the case might be if we needed to do that. And I know some of the other counterparts are aware of that as well. If you think about it, we do some evacuation on in our athletics on the weekends with the numerous athletics we had. Many different athletics going on, and with that, our parking and transportation committee or department has implemented some signs, and with the upcoming stadium being built, there's plans for moving those people both to campus but also away from campus, utilizing things like the RTMC, which is the regional transportation camera system, but also some of our own signs that we put on campus to help direct traffic.
So I would imagine it might be a little different if there was radio announcements saying that there was a biological or a radioactive dirty bomb that had gone off, or a Monticello nuke plant had a leak and there was fallout emerging, a little more panic than after a football game. But I'm just wondering if, because I've been in these meetings before, but I haven't heard of a lot of discussion of whether or not we're prepared to move whole regions of people, and I'd like to get a review of that, hopefully as maybe the scope of our meeting.
If I can just mention,
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to say that I think we're working on traffic management plans, but if we're at the very early stages of evacuating whole communities, we have the ability right now to evacuate small areas of an urban city or possibly protect employees, but we have a long way to go for a mass evacuation plan. Even the traffic management plans we have, we can get people out of the city, but where do we put them? Where do they go? When do they come back? We're in the very, very early stages of that.
Dr. Osterholm?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I think to follow up on your comment, Senator Lerner, and to yours, Chief, is the fact that we're really taking a step back and rethinking evacuation, because really short of some very limited event situations like a chemical spill and so forth, and even a dirty bomb has a very limited footprint, unless it's such an explosive device that it becomes no longer a dirty bomb. And part of it was what happened after 9/11 was the evacuation of Washington, D.C. gave a lot of people a sense that that was the thing to do. And if you look at biologics, for example, I cannot imagine any event where we'd evacuate the University of Minnesota short of a major chemical spill or a dirty bomb in a very localized area, which we wouldn't evacuate everybody else. And so I think part of it is right now taking a step back and saying, what are the events you really need to evacuate for? Which would you keep them there? For example, if we had a major aerosol release of most infectious agents, we would actually want to keep people here, because once the cloud passes, it's gone. And, in fact, the ability to access those people for prophylactic medicines and so forth is enhanced by keeping them right here where they're at and keeping them right on the spot. And so just I wouldn't take the post-9/11 initial reaction as where we're at today. And I can't imagine anything short of even a nuclear device in the Twin Cities we'd mass evacuate the entire Twin Cities. I just don't think that there's anything that would warrant or merit that. That, in fact, would not make matters worse and actually make them better.
Wow. Any other questions for the University of Minnesota testifiers? Representative Lane.
Just one quick one. You said you had the 800 megahertz system. Do you know if the other colleges around do have it, or if it's important for the smaller colleges?
You know, there are very few campuses that actually have a police agency associated with them, and they're actually all in the University of Minnesota system. Ourselves, Duluth, and Morris. So They do, you know, we have good working, close working relationships in our campus, for instance, with Augsburg, so we have communications with them, but they're not part of the 800 megahertz system that is, you know, a governmental radio system.
If I could just add another piece and follow up, and obviously I'm wearing two hats around at the university. I think one of the questions kept last time, and Rockley raised that appropriately so, was what was in that building underneath the bridge. One of the things the university has is an extensive inventory of everything we have on campus, and I've been very involved with the issue on the infectious agents. We can tell you every laboratory with every freezer where every bug is, so that if should an event happen where we need to respond, we can tell you where every animal is relative to any potential animal resources. And as you know, we have many animals on both the St. Paul Minneapolis campus relative to research that's ongoing. So part of it is, at the incident command scene, one of the things you do is quickly pull up that inventory like they would the fire department pull up the blueprint of a building, and an assessment made immediately if there is some event taking place, what are the potential risks thereof to either officers to the first responders, to the people who were there, et cetera. And so, and Chief Hustings knows we have really one of the most detailed inventories of anybody in the country, I think, right now relative to our university.
Mayor Anderson.
And with the conversations I've had with the Department of Public Safety and the Fusion Centers, there's extensive plans in place for nuclear accidents or nuclear spills associated with nuclear plants in Minnesota. Extensive plans for more localized evacuations.
I support that. Dr. Alex, thank you for bringing that up. I'd just like to say that once we identified that hazard, Lance was actually the one who handled it from the university. Within seconds of asking the question, he was able to identify what was in the building and put a plan together and handle the situation for the city of Minneapolis.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Which, can I just go back to part? Because yes, I think one of the things the legislature needs to understand, and I think you do, but this takes a lot of work to do this kind of thing before the scene. You know, I think, I mean, I give, as I, you heard me say last week, I give Rockwell incredible credit for what they've done. But it was what happened at the scene that was amazing. But what was remarkable is what happened before that bridge ever collapsed that allowed what happened at the scene to be amazing. And I think that that's not cheap to do. And oftentimes it gets put into one's regular job experience. Just go do this. Just do this and have this all there. And keep it current. Well, you know, it can't be last week's newspaper. It's got to be tomorrow's headlines if you're going to be on top of it. And I think just understanding, and I think all the people around the room here who are involved with emergency management always get fingered or they get accolades at the time a crisis happens. And it's not often understood that there is very busy during all the non-crisis times. And that's a resource issue. And that's, I think, a very important point to keep remembering when we think about allocation of resources and needs. It's really important.
Well, that's very good. We'll have a finance overview next week.
We'll find out there isn't enough.
Right. There's never enough, of course. And if there's no further questions, we will proceed with the Minnesota National Guard.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We have Lieutenant Colonel Eric Waggy, Colonel Rich Weaver, and Colonel Eric Allness. And gentlemen, we have three testifiers and a goal of trying to be done in the next 15 minutes. We hope that is somewhat possible. Proceed and identify yourself for the record.
Sir, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Eric Waggy. I'm the Chief of Interagency Operations for the Minnesota National Guard, and I'm responsible for ensuring that during a time of disaster, the Minnesota National Guard provides efficient and effective support to the requesting civilian agency. And as part of that, you know, I have interest in training activities of the Minnesota National Guard. You know, the Guard has a long history of being involved in domestic disasters, stretching way back to when the state first started. You can't imagine a disaster really in our state that we haven't been part of. And through that time, we've forged very close personal relationships with our friends in emergency management and police and fire and all that kind of stuff. But I will say that after the Second World War, our institutions diverged. Prior to the Second World War, there wasn't a lot of emergency management institutions that extended beyond the municipal levels and things like that, there was not a lot of oversight, and so the military took those charge of that. But during the Cold War, we went off and became our own unique system and developed our own lingo, and emergency management evolved separately, came up with its own incident command system, its own lingo, its own equipment, and so now we're trying, in the wake of Katrina and 9/11, to move us back toward commonality with our traditional roles as National Guardsmen of supporting our state. We've done the international mission very well, and we continue to do so. And we do our state role very well too, but it's held together with personal relationships, and in our charge is to make our institutions get closer. And so it's not personal based. What that means is that we're going to have to adopt terminology and processes and procedures that dovetail with NIMS. And I can tell you that the United States Coast Guard has done that and made NIMS their domestic plans now. They don't have military operations orders plans any longer in the United States. They use NIMS and incident action plans. And the United States Air Force, and along with them, the Minnesota National Guard, is doing the same thing. We had recently, or fairly recently, the services ordered by the Goldwater-Nichols Act to join together and come up with common procedures. We haven't had a similar effort for emergency management, nor I don't really see one coming. I think this is more of a cooperative effort. But along those lines, we've participated in training that the state offers and that the federal government offers. And again, that there is no career track in our field for emergency management. It's an individual passion and an individual effort. And we have a lot of people that are passionate and interested in those kind of trainings. Our training standards in the military are set by the federal government and the Pentagon. They're not set locally here. And so we don't track these kind of things as we should. And that's something that we're putting together is training tracking. And so if we know that people have certain qualifications and skill sets, that we're going to begin to track those. And we're putting those things together, but we do have quite a robust capability in Minnesota, and Minnesota wants to be a leader in the development of our ability to support our local responders. So to that end, we've heard about the certification programs that emergency managers take. We have 21 individuals in the National Guard that are certified that way. We have several hundred that meet the basic NIMS qualifications. The advanced NIMS qualification, we have a few dozen that meet that, and so we're working very hard to integrate ourselves and learn the terminology and lingo, and then also the specialty training with, for instance, wildland fire with the Forest Service. We annually, our air crews undergo DNR training and U.S. Forest Service training to allow them to work on the major fires that we've had in recent years. We actually have a lot of structural firefighters in our organization, and they go through qualifications for that. Hazardous materials groups are trained by the EPA, and so we're beginning to become much more interagency in our outlook. And I think one of the proposals that Colonel Weaver is going to speak to will even assist us further along those lines of building an exercise component that not only is classroom training oriented, but also will be field exercise oriented up at Camp Ripley as well. So in the interest of time, I'll pass it over to Colonel Weaver.
Thank you. Colonel Weaver.
Okay, I'm Colonel Weaver. I'm the post commander at Camp Ripley. As Eric talked about our capabilities, I'm going to talk about the place we train for those capabilities, and that's Camp Ripley. For those that don't know, Camp Ripley is a 53,000-acre state-owned controlled access facility. We have state-of-the-art military things, ranges, all of our ranges from individual weapons to tank ranges. We have simulations for all of those parts. We have millions of square feet of facility space and classrooms, training buildings, offices, maintenance, medical, all those things for training. And we provide the logistical support in billeting, food, fuels, and those kind of things to the people that come there. We also have an airfield there and rail capability to bring things in, and we we have security 24-hour, 24/7, 365 days a year. A little bit about Camp Ripley. What Eric was talking about earlier is our current, what we're really working on currently, and that's a building effort to improve our urban training capabilities, and that's really a lot of where NIMS and all those are. And currently, starting in this spring, we're going to be building a combined arms collective training facility. And if you look at the handouts, I think you got all those handouts there. That gives you a little bit, kind of a picture. I'm not going to go through that in a lot of detail, but a picture of kind of what that would look like. And then and above there is the actual footprint of the buildings we're going to have. As you can see on there, it's a 24-building, multi-story urban complex. It's a $20 million project, multi-purpose automated facility. This project fully meets the training needs of our soldiers, and we realize that it also meets many of the needs for our civilian emergency management first responder type organizations. We are already heavily used by a lot of the state entities, state and local entities. Just for instance, the DNR runs their academy there, their officer academy, and it was there just sent this year so far. We count people in person days, but 4,200 person days. Minnesota State Patrol also runs their academy there, and some of their other training, EVOC training, those kind of things, and they were there over 2,300 person days this year so far. And MnDOT's also a pretty big player, does all their snowplow training there, and some of their maintenance training courses there also, and they were there over 4,000 person days so far this year. We also do have police forces, sheriff departments, and fire training there. And we provide local or a location for numerous multi-agent training exercises, as Eric talked about there. With that facility going in, we've seen a lot more interest from those users to come to Camp Ripley and do additional training and maybe to add to this facility. We're going to build this facility. It meets the soldiers' training needs, but there's been discussions already in adding fire training, CLAPS facilities, EOC. We talked about EOC, but maybe a training EOC or a backup EOC at Camp Ripley out of the metro area and driving course. Further, with those things, there's also been some talking of billeting facilities and more full-time presence of state agencies being on Camp Ripley. And overall, our goal for Camp Ripley is to be a full-spectrum training center for not only the military but all the civilian. We are a state-owned facility, and we'd like to have the state agencies and others come train there. Thanks.
Colonel Allness.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colonel Eric Allness, Director of Government Relations. So where Rich left off, you know, Camp Ripley serves not only as logistics base, not only for the National Guard, but potentially for a broader space for Minnesota. It also provides that state training base, too, where we can come together interagency, intergovernment, and with volunteers and so forth to help train individuals up. We also have an opportunity a lot closer to the metro area. The old Arden Hills Ammunition Plant has been turned over, at least 1,500 acres of that has been turned over to the National Guard. We're looking at long-term development through putting in a new state headquarters for the National Guard there, excuse me, and which would also be our emergency operations center for the National Guard. Obviously, that opened up opportunity a little bit outside that 494-694 loop where potentially the state could also partner with us in a secure environment where they could put in some sort of operation center or partner with us so we can get more for the value what we're putting in there. So I know public safety is considering that and is looking at those options. Also, we do have a number of simulators there. Again, we're not going to be doing live firing in that area, but simulators where people, soldiers can go there and train on weekends, but also the law enforcement and emergency responders could also on a limited basis use that on more of a individual or small level, and then if they want to do a large collective level training or interagency, they could also go to Camp Ripley. want to transition. So that's some of the training facilities we currently have or are putting in place. We also continually look at how well we do to the emergencies that came up, or even if we don't have a large part, what could have happened that would have necessitated calling us in. So we did a gap analysis of the I-35 bridge collapse and also the southeast Minnesota flash floods and said, what did we do or what potentially could have come in and what gaps were there that we could not address? Often people look at the Minnesota National Guard as an agency of last resort. We have to come in and we need to be able to provide the support if no one else can. So we came up with some areas that we wanted to look at that we're going to explore to see if we can improve our services. First of all, in communications, that's one of the things you hear throughout is communications. We currently have three trailers that we can move around the state that would provide a large degree of capability for communications, network, radio, and satellite communications. This year we're going to add C-130 portability to it so we'll be able to get it anywhere in the state in a very timely manner. Also, we're looking at adding in, and this would be a potential cell provider capability. Basically, we'd link up with Quest or Verizon or any of the cell providers, and we would act as a cellular tower. Emergency responders would come on as a subscriber with us, and we would be the cell provider for that area. Obviously, in something like the I-35 bridge where the systems are saturated, that would be a way for us to link up with emergency responders and provide a backbone that didn't exist until that trailer showed up. Additionally, we're looking at more robust frequency modulation capability. As was talked about, eventually we all want to get to that 800 megahertz dream, but especially in greater Minnesota, that capability is going to be a few years down the road. So we have the capability to do the frequency modulation to help different capabilities talk to one another, but that's something, especially in a larger event, we would need to get more robust so that, we can provide that capability. Additionally, we have to look at retrans capabilities. We found out in southeastern Minnesota, as you're in some of those areas, you just can't talk out of the holes in the ground, or if you're way up north fighting forest fires, sometimes you don't always have the right communications to communicate. So we're looking at two options for retransmission of radio frequencies. First one would be a blimp, and we don't have that innate capability in the military, in the Minnesota National Guard. There is a JLIN system which allows rebroadcast of frequencies. You'll see a lot on the southern border of the United States, but we could use that capability as a potential dual use, but mostly a state-based capability. Positive on that, it has more durability and more weather conditions, has very good endurance and low operating costs. Unfortunately, it's not mobile, and we don't have the tactical units. We don't have the soldiers or airmen that are trained to use that skill. The second thing we could look at is unmanned aerial vehicle, and we do have some of those units in the state, and it is mobile, but unfortunately, the strengths I mentioned on the blimp are kind of the weaknesses on the UAV, getting that unmanned aerial vehicle. But we're looking at that, and of course, we'll have to work closely with the FAA because the FAA has very strident restrictions of use of those type of systems in the continental U.S. But again, we're looking out there, identifying potential gaps that we could address to make sure that we could be there when no one else can talk or no one else can get through. The other thing we're looking at, and I addressed it briefly before, is emergency operations center or emergency housing capability. We have 64 facilities throughout the state, generally spread throughout the entire state, and we see the need to provide a capability for displaced civilians, stranded travelers, which we do on a very regular basis, and also for emergency workers to make sure that's there. So we're going to look at our local armories and see what can we do to provide the update to them, the upgrades, so that they could serve as that emergency operation center for a regional area or for emergency responders. First of all, we have very good communications going in. We have at least T1 lines, which is very fast lines for computer networks going in facilities. And then also we have to look then how could we tie in that trailer which has emergency power generation or standalone emergency power generation at each of those facilities to make sure that they would be able to provide that. Also, our emergency responders could roll up in their trucks and just hook into our existing network or supplement off of our systems. Also, the emergency housing capability, we can do that in the pinch. However, we'd like to see more environmentally controlled facilities so we could provide, especially in the summertime for extended periods, sprinkler systems, again, to make sure that our emergency housing wouldn't provide us a place for a disaster itself, and then also enhanced locker, bathroom facilities and stuff like that. If people are going to have to be there for a while, we'd be looking at that. And again, this doesn't all have to come to the state. A lot of these things are things that our federal partners can help us with, or as a joint federal-state partnership to work in. And then finally, as I talked about, we have existing very good infra and infrastructures, but we just want to continue to develop those so we can provide that redundancy to the state responders. As I said, we have it in radio, we have it in satellite, and also for computer systems. So to summarize, what we do is we have the professional accreditation and the training to understand the other's roles and to be an expert in our role. We have world-class training facilities, and we're working to improve them and our facilities to train our personnel and present opportunities for other emergency responders to take part. And then finally, we continue to address potential shortfalls and bridge a gap where other resources may not reach. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was a lot of information.
Yeah.
Almost made it.
Almost.
Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, just a brief one, I think maybe for Colonel Weaver. I just always wondered if local law enforcement comes up to Camp Ripley for a week to train or something, do they pay rent or do they pay anything to you, or do you let them come up gratis? I'm just always curious how that works.
Thanks for the question. What we do is the federal government actually mandates what we can charge, and we can only charge the exact cost it cost us for, like, electricity and water, and so we have to do a formula and charge for each of those. Whatever they would use, we charge that amount back to whoever the customer is.
Thank you.
Dr. Osterholm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Obviously, one of the issues that's come up over and over again has been how stretched the National Guards are around the country relative to foreign deployment and their ability actually to, if a major catastrophe of some ongoing proportion and ongoing time took place in this country. It may be difficult for you to give a sense of your estimate of strength of force and your ability to do that, but how are you being compromised right now relative to your ability to carry out your state functions, as you well described them, relative to the stretch that's occurring because of foreign deployment?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Osterholm, we have 13,500 members of the National Guard. During the high point of deployments, when the brigade combat team was deployed, the 148th was deployed, fighter wing, and the 133rd air wing was deployed, we still had 5,600 citizen soldiers ready to respond within hours of an emergency. So even though we had a large amount of people deployed, we had enough personnel on hand, but also we had the right kind of equipment too. We still had a lot of trucks, and we had the type of things that we need to respond in a state emergency. Now, obviously, if there was, and there's some of these catastrophic events talked about earlier, if they came in, that would stretch us even if we had everyone here. But we continue to plan, and we always make sure that we have the right units online ready to go on short notice should they be called, and we rotate that based on the missions that we have and when people are expected to deploy for a federal mission.
Can I just follow up question, Mr. Chair? Thank you. Colonel, thank you, because why is some states seem to be hit? The governor of Oklahoma made it very clear that they were stretched beyond capacity publicly, whether that was a political statement or not. But I heard the Adjutant General recently of Iowa's National Guard say that they were missing their major pieces of equipment, that they were still in Iraq, that they didn't have them. I was actually at a meeting in which he spoke, and he was very candid about his concern about that issue. So how is Minnesota different than the other states that have identified themselves as having serious problems because of deployment?
Mr. Chair, a couple things. First of all, even though we're 21st in population, we got the sixth largest guard in the country.
Okay.
So we've been very successful. We have a larger proportion of the guard versus what most populations have. We could, and it's kind of hard for us to say it's Minnesota nice, but we're a darn good guard. We're the best in the country. And I can say that objectively. We just were recognized with the Army Communities of Excellence being the best guard in the country for 2007. And you can look through the performance of our units in combat. They're always amongst the top. So we have a lot of mature institutions in place that help us plan well to make sure we have the right things on hand. We just look at Lieutenant Colonel Waggy here, who has over a decade experience working with emergency responders, and his predecessor, who had at least that much on there too. So we have, over the long term, developed quality programs and put people in place and invest that time in there to make sure we could respond. And You know, it'd be inappropriate for us to answer other states because we don't know their specific circumstances. But it is a little bit hard. It is hard for us to do our planning and make sure the capabilities are present.
Thank you.
Senator Limmer?
I keep hearing a lot about the 800 megahertz capability, and how much room is in at 800 megahertz capability until it's saturated? It seems like every law enforcement agency wants to use it and wants to have access to it. Now the military wants to have access to it. And what is the, I don't know what the capability of 800 megahertz is. Does anyone know?
Mr. Forte?
I probably can't give you a technical answer on that, but I can tell you the night of the bridge collapse, we had 114,000 radio pushes in about 6 hours, and they told me we had 30% of our capability left. So it seems to be very large and very robust. And quite frankly, after being in emergency preparedness of the fire department for 34 years, it's rare that you use that much of capability. You know, you probably use 1 to 5% of your radio's capabilities a day. During the disasters, you may go up to 60 to 70%.
My former state senator, before I became a state senator, became Hennepin County Sheriff, Pat McGowan. And I heard more about 800 megahertz radio communication than I ever cared to know about. But I never heard what the capacity was. And it was kind of an elusive, esoteric type vision of some radio system, but I never knew what the capacity was. And could one feasibly be putting all of our emergency eggs in one basket with 1-800 megahertz, or is that something that's not logical?
I personally don't think so, but I don't have enough background to give you a definitive answer. Okay. I can tell you that I've worked with a radio system prior to this and this radio system, and there's absolutely no comparing. It's the Cadillac radio system.
Mr. Chair, how much of the state has 800 megahertz now? It isn't even a quarter, I don't think, is it?
You know, from my knowledge of our 800 operations, it's the metropolitan area, and then there's a finger that goes up the I-94 corridor toward Alexandria, and then another finger that goes south towards Rochester, and that's about where we're at now. But I think there's some islands out there as well, and those places escape me. But it's a growing system, and it's a good one. And the advantage of 800 megahertz is that it slices the frequency band thinner than the old systems do, so you get more out of that one band than you ever had before. And they're also talking about opening up 700 megahertz, which will radically increase our capability as well.
Thank you. One more thing.
I'd just like to add the fact that when you brought up using Camp Ripley as a training site, I think what made Minneapolis the most successful at the 35W bridge was the fact that we went out to Mount Weather in 202 and exercised our emergency operations plan. To be able to have a in-state facility where cities could go and do that, I think, is really the answer to identifying our resources and our gap analysis. So I would highly support that, and I think that's definitely the right direction to go.
Very well. If there's nothing further, we will be adjourned until next Monday.
I have a general question.
Yes.
Do we have the speakers lined up for the next
We do
meeting?
Have...
I would like to know those, that it was state and local government funding.
Yes, I wonder if Alice could comment on who the specific people are.
Right now it's someone from the Department of Finance. They'll do a general overview of state funding, and then we have MnDOT, Department of Health, Health and Human Services, and then Department of Public Safety will do an agency overview. And then we have Minneapolis and St. Paul, and we've reached out to some other cities to see if they're willing to come in. If
you have government in general, perhaps,
if you have
sort of cities.
If you have suggestions, I can talk to you after, and you can make sure they're here too.
Because it sounds kind of heavy on state and light on.
That's why we value your perspective, ma'am. The following two meetings will be January 7th, here in room, not in this room, at the Capitol at room 112, and January 21st at room 112 at the Capitol. Both of those agendas are to be announced. Thank you very much. And
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's stuck. Have you signed yours?
I signed mine.
You signed yours? God,